From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Overconsumption, the American way. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. This is the holiday when gluttony is not just acceptable, it's almost required if you try to taste everything on the Thanksgiving table. But ask yourself, is this the only time you eat more than you ought to? Obesity is a national epidemic, and overconsumption of another kind is on the rise. Credit card debt is up by 66% since last year, and by 368% since 2009. When the Great Recession made Americans try to be frugal. Why do we want so much more than we can afford, and probably more than we need? Is there a relationship between mindless eating and manic buying? On Reporter's Notebook later on, practicing gratitude. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To the Point. This isn't the only day that Americans eat too much, and even in the aftermath of the Great Recession, we are now buying too much, too. Today, we'll hear that overconsumption is a feature not just of our culture, but of our psychology. We are wired for it. Does the remedy lie in taking control of one's own environment? On Reporter's Notebook, even advocates admit it sounds hokey, but practicing gratitude is one way to make yourself happy. We'll hear about that and more. First, this news update, the Transportation Security Administration has lost its way, according to a committee of Congress, in a report concluding that the TSA needs reform. The U.S. Travel Association says the thing that bugs passengers most is people who bring too many carry-on bags through security. Airlines encourage that practice by charging as much as $25 to check a suitcase. Bart Jansen covers transportation for USA Today. And Bart, on this very busy transport day in the transportation area, thanks a lot for joining our program.
Thanks for having me.
Let's talk first about the $25 to check a suitcase. Is that something that the airlines need to do now in order to stay in business?
Yeah, they would argue that with deregulation, they've had to try to basically figure out user fees for each part of what used to be the complete plane ticket. And so charging for bags is just one piece that they're trying to make up the cost of the flight.
How much of a problem does it cause, not just for the passengers on the plane when everybody's bumping along with a big, dense bag, but for the TSA?
Well, what it's done is it's forced people, well, it prompted people to bring less checked luggage. They try to squeeze more into the carry-ons. The carry-ons have gotten bigger, and people are trying to bring as many carry-ons as possible. And so that has backed up security lines more, and it makes more for TSA to have to search through.
Does it also make it more likely that they'll miss stuff?
Well, TSA would like to say, you know, they catch everything,
right?
Well, they screened like 5 billion people so far over the first decade that they've been in creation, and they caught something like 1,100 guns trying to go through carry-on this year alone. So they try to catch everything, but occasionally things do slip through.
Has the TSA had to increase staff because of this?
Well, the agency has grown in this first decade. They just celebrated their 10th anniversary last Saturday. But they have grown to 65,000 people, which several members of Congress think is too large. They think that they've become bloated and top-heavy.
On the other hand, when you have situations like we're discussing right now, the airlines may be part of the problem.
Well, I guess there's an argument, though, that you need to search the bags one way or another. If it was a checked bag, you'd like to screen it before it goes into the belly of the plane. If it's a carry-on bag, then you want to check it before somebody could perhaps pull a weapon out of the bag during the flight. But one way or another, I think people would like to have it checked. I guess it's sort of a question of how to check the luggage most efficiently.
So it's not a question of more people, then. It's a question of where they have to be.
Yes.
What are some of the other issues that the Congress is concerned about?
Well, Chairman John Mica of the Transportation Committee thinks that the agency has grown too large, that they make bad decisions, such as buying screening machines that don't work, and that essentially the country should shift back to private screening, hiring private companies to actually hire the people who stand at those gates and look at all your luggage going through the machines, and just have the TSA be an oversight body, you know, the checks, make sure that they do everything correctly, and basically sort of an oversight agency. Now, his proposal hasn't picked up much steam yet, but that's what he'd like to see done.
Does he agree with the TSA's claim that they're doing a good job of security? Because there have, as I understand, according to this report, been something like 25,000 security breaches.
Yeah, he's very critical of the agency. He thinks that they have basically not improved safety over the last 10 years, that the real protection against terrorists is that passengers themselves will take their safety into their own hands, as we saw as early as September 11th with the flight that crashed in Pennsylvania. But TSA spokesman says that this kind of criticism is a disservice to these people that are trying to do the best job that they can, that they've become much more professional, that they screen a ton of people, and that, you know, we haven't had any horrific incidents in the past 10 years.
And as to the machinery that he claims doesn't really work, does that include the body scanners, or have they gotten a better report card?
He's critical of the way they've deployed the full-body scanners, because many times they don't work. They're not staffed, or they're located in places where basically they're just not handy to be used. And so he thinks they've done a poor job of deploying them. There is another type of machine that's no longer in use called a puffer machine, which was supposed to detect explosives, and that just proved unable to actually even find explosives reliably, and so they've just shelved that entirely.
Okay, so on one of the busiest travel weekends of the year, Bart Jansen with USA Today. Thanks very much for being on our program. In a moment, overconsumption, the American way, on To The Point.
To The Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warman Olney back with To The Point. It's traditional on this holiday to eat more than we need, but in fact, that is what we do most of the time, as statistics on the rate of obesity make all too clear. Brian Wansink is a professor of eating behavior and director of Cornell University's Food and Brand Lab. He's author of Mindless Eating, Why We May Eat More Than We Think. Brian Wansink, good to have you on our program.
Yeah, it's great to be with you. Thanks.
Mindless Eating. What a wonderful title. Why do you say we're engaged in mindless eating?
Well, you know, basically, as clued in as we think we are to our food environment, we are a nation of mindless eaters. And what messes us up, though, isn't necessarily that the food's necessarily great or it's really cheap or affordable or available, but it's also simply because of these cues that are around us, what the person is doing next to us, the size of our plate, the lighting, the distance something from our hands, they have tremendous impacts on how much we eat. And the good thing is, with most of these, we can turn them around to work for us rather than against us.
Well, let's talk a little bit, first of all, of how they work against us. What do you mean the size of the plate leads you to overeat?
Well, you know, if I were to say, hey, how much is the right amount of stuffing to put in your plate, or pasta or corn, whatever you're having for Thanksgiving, you'd kind of go, well, I don't know, whatever just seems like the right amount. But we find that if you take, for instance, a 10-inch plate, the typical person will serve about 3 to 4 ounces of pasta on a 10-inch plate. But if that plate goes up to 12 inches in diameter, which is basically what most of us have in our house, the typical person in our studies ends up eating about 22% more, because all of a sudden that 3 or 4 ounces, I mean, it doesn't even look like an appetizer size on a 12-inch plate. So what do? You plop down another scoop.
Do commercial people know about this?
You know, it's interesting. As smart as commercial people are, they have a lot of things on their plate and on their mind that I think make them almost as astonished as we are when we end up showing the results of a lot of these studies.
What are some of the other things, some of the other cues that are around us and about us that cause us to eat more than we really, than we realize, the mindless eating problem?
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, we've done a number of studies where we've taken secretaries and we've either put Hershey Kisses right on their desk, or we put it simply 6 feet away, and we find that Hershey Kisses that are just 2 steps away from the desk end up being eaten with about half the frequency. The typical person will eat 4 of them if they're 6 feet away. They'll eat 9 if they're on their desk. If we say, hey, what's the deal? Why aren't you eating the ones that are in the jar just 6 feet away? Is it too far to walk? People will say, no, but that just gives me pause to say, hey, am I really that hungry? And half the time I answer no. But we've seen this in the same way in Thanksgiving, and we've done studies with Thanksgiving appetizers where simply moving them in different locations around the house drops how much they're eaten by about half, as long as it's 5 or more feet away from a person.
Of course, in that case, Grandma or whoever it is that's fixing the dinner wants you to eat more rather than less.
You know, what's interesting about that, one of the reasons that people end up overeating in Thanksgiving, other than it's a great holiday and stuff, it's partly the pleasing principle. You know, you want to please that person that's been laboring away for the last 24 hours in that turkey and that stuffing. That we did something a while back that says that's one of the main reasons people end up getting seconds and thirds with food. But one of the things we did in a study just a couple years ago is we discovered that a hostess has no idea how much food you took. But what they do remember is whether you asked for seconds. So if you were to take a tablespoon of dressing, but ask for seconds and go back for a second tablespoon, all that Aunt Edna would remember is that you liked the stuff so much, you went back for seconds.
What about other days besides the Thanksgiving, though, and what are some of the other cues that lead to overeating? And I gather what you're saying is that our brains are really wired to do this in our own homes.
Yeah, I mean, because the thing is, we live in an incredible society where, I mean, food is available, it's affordable, it's lots of variety. I mean, and that's just sort of the perfect storm for us to eat with abandon. But even on a day-to-day basis, we'll find that we did a study that showed that when you open the cupboard in the morning and look at your cereals, you are 3 times more likely to take the first cereal you see, first breakfast cereal you see, than the 4th or 5th. So simply arranging a cabinet in a way so that the first thing you see is the healthiest almost predisposes you to eating a little healthier than you otherwise would. And the same thing goes for your refrigerator. If we were going to look at breakfast, we even found in a bunch of studies that if you have 2 glasses of the same volume, let's say they both hold 16 ounces, but one's short and fat and the other's tall and skinny, you'll pour and drink about 30% more into that short, wide glass than you will the tall, skinny one. So if you're looking for an easy way to cut down how much juice you drink in the morning, how much soda pop you drink in the afternoon, an easy way to do it is just get rid of all your short white glasses.
back to the cereals. Maybe they all taste the same, and that's why people pick the first one rather than...
I know. It's a pretty good treat. You know, but what goes on, we've even done a number of things with little kids, little 4-year-old kids, and what we found is that even with 4-year-olds, 4- and 6-year-olds, that they'll end up pouring and eating about 44% more out of an 18-ounce cereal bowl than they will a 12-ounce cereal bowl. But what do you suppose most of them eat out of in the morning? Yeah, it's our cereal bowls.
You got it.
18-ounce ones.
Brian Wansink again with Cornell University. We'll come back and talk with you further. But I want to introduce Peter Weibrow, psychiatrist, director of the Semmel Institute for Neuroscience and Human Behavior at UCLA. He's author of American Mania, When More is Not Enough. Good to have you on our program.
Thank you.
So this might well work for eating, and we'll hear more about eating as we go along today. But you're talking about something more than that, not just eating, but also buying.
Yes. I mean, I completely agree with Brian and his elegant studies. They absolutely confirm that our brain is essentially a hybrid, and we grew up in scarcity. In terms of our evolution. So now we find ourselves in this abundant environment, whether it be food or information or whatever else, which we call affluence, a continuous flow of novelty. And in that circumstance, we just don't really have the regulation unless we bring it into our circumstances by thinking about it to contain ourselves. So instinctively we will eat. I mean, that's the example of the chocolate kisses closer to you, or the chocolate cake, or the turkey breast, or whatever it is. If it's close to you, it's very difficult to resist. If you have to get up and go get it, then in fact you think about it, and your cognitive area, the very front of your brain, which is really quite small, about the size of your thumb, that lateral prefrontal cortex can contain you and say, well, that looks exciting and interesting and tasty, but I'm not really hungry, and therefore I'm not going to eat it because I don't want to gain 20 pounds this year. But it's very much a division of the brain that we have, which is the oldest part, comes from the primitive part of us, call it the lizard brain, and the new human brain, which is the cognitive part, which gives us the ability to choose rather than just to go along with instinct.
Lizard brain gets blamed for an awful lot of things. How does this apply, I should say, to shopping?
Well, it's the same sort of thing, actually. I mean, if you have a continuous stream of opportunity, and especially if it's there in front of you in every modality that you see, I mean, we live in a extraordinarily intense advertising community now, where everything is thrust in front of us with the hope that we're going to buy it, then of course it's very difficult to stop. It's exactly the same as being teased by food as you go out of the grocery store, where it's all in those little racks where all the good sweets are, you know, just before you leave. The kids are a good index of that. They have very little way in the way of cognitive control, and they will, you know, drive their parents crazy if they see that stuff, but that's, of course, what the marketeer knows.
How important is variety? There's an awful lot of that as well.
Yes, variety is very important, although there is some evidence that as the variety increases, the choices become confused and the individual actually doesn't make very good choices. So if you've got three or four items, people will actually buy more than if you've got a choice of 25 items.
Mm. So there is some point then at which the rule tends to change. What is it about novelty and the variety of options, at least up to a point, that triggers our brains to want more?
Well, if you think about us way back, you know, when we lived in small groups and we lived out in the open and life was sort of troublesome, you had to keep a pretty good inspection on the horizon and other things around you. So, in fact, it was useful to be able to attend to anything that changed, anything that was different, anything that moved, anything that was bright, anything that was made a big noise. You would immediately attend to that. That's in the brain's function, something driven by a chemistry called dopamine, and that's the way in which we attend to novelty. So if you go into a bar these days, for example, and you just look at the faces, you see that even though the television isn't on in terms of sound, it is on in terms of its flickering picture, and people will look up at that. And it's because we are all attuned to any change in our environment. And so novelty, when you have a very affluent environment, affluence defined as a continuous flow of novelty, then we continuously pay attention to it. That's why, for example, many people become addicted to checking their email, and now we have these handheld systems. What people used to do when they took out their a packet of cigarettes when they were feeling socially vacant or embarrassed, they now take out their little handsets and check on whether or not somebody sent them a message, because that's novel, yes?
It is indeed. So we have a problem then with the brain, and I take it, as Brian Wansink suggests, we're unaware of it most of the time.
Yes, we are.
What do we do about it?
Well, it's an intuitive sense that we have, which comes from our heritage. But Brian's absolutely right. I completely agree with him that if in fact you can stand back from that, you can turn those old intuitive behaviors, which are the preconscious behaviors, just liking sweet things and meat and all that other stuff, and you can turn them into a system where you can regulate yourself. But it does take some discipline and it takes some education. And we have to do it in our current environment. I mean, let's remember, Thanksgiving used to be a celebration at the end of the summer, just before the winter came on, when all the fruits were available, the beasts were fat, and we sat down and had a wonderful feast, knowing that, in fact, for the next few months we're going to be pretty lean. We don't have pretty lean months anymore because we're trucking things around the country, and you can get anything you want any time of the day just by going to the corner store. You don't have to go out and dig it up or to chase it through the woods. I mean, it's a totally different way of living.
Peter Weibrow, again, psychiatrist at UCLA. We'll come back, talk more with him as well. First, before we need to go to our break, let me introduce Mark Bittman. He's a columnist for the Opinion Pages and the magazine of the New York Times, very well-known man. For many years, served as the paper's minimalist food writer. He's the author of many cookbooks, including How to Cook Everything. And Mark Bittman, I won't ask you how to do that on this program. We don't have time, but thanks very much for being back on our show. It's good to hear from you.
Nice to talk with you, too.
You have made it a mission to get people to make the right choices in this regard. And one of the choices that you are pushing very hard is the choice of not getting the food at the restaurant, particularly at the fast food restaurant, but cooking it yourself.
Well, you know, Thanksgiving really isn't the problem. The previous speaker said, the thing is that Thanksgiving was a feast, and feasts are fine. The problem is we can feast all the time, and we do, and food is available everywhere and every time, and we are now trained pretty much to eat in any situation, in any place. It's all socially acceptable now, and as a result, you know, we know the result. We're eating too much. So one possible answer is to go back to controlling what we eat, and the way to do that, Brian alluded to this actually, is have the right foods around and choose from the right foods. And if you are in the habit of cooking in your own house, if you're in the habit of eating in your own house, if you're in the habit of shopping for yourself, then it's inevitable that you're going to make better choices. And you know, another key is not to think that you need to make perfect choices, but to think that you need to make better choices, and that you're moving along on kind of a spectrum towards having a saner, more reasonable diet.
I'm happy to tell you that my granddaughter likes to tell me to make healthy choices, she says to me. So she must be in the right environment. We're going to take a very brief break, come back and continue our conversation with Mark Bittman and Peter Weibrow and Brian Winsink on Reporter's Notebook, Gratitude and Happiness. Back in a minute with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warren Olney, back with To the Point on this Thanksgiving Day with the Christmas season coming right up. We're talking about mindless eating and manic buying. Mark Bittman, food columnist and now columnist for the Opinion Pages of the New York Times, just said that it's good to have feasts. That's what we're doing today, and that's perfectly okay, but that we ought to learn how to make better choices and not feast every day of the year. Mark Bittman, what about the distinction that you have made in a recent column between junk food and the cost of cooking for yourself, buying your own food, and just the whole distinction that you make between choosing junk food and choosing cooking?
Well, there's an undeniable convenience to junk food, and a great deal of Brian's work is given to demonstrate that and demonstrate it admirably. But the convenience at what cost? The convenience with damage to our health and damage to the environment. So the clear way to gain control over what you eat and over ultimately what your health is to start cooking it yourself, or at least preparing it yourself. It doesn't necessarily have to involve heat. But the difference between the nutritional benefits of real food and the nutritional unbenefits of junk food are stark. And, we're increasingly eating. I mean, the official statistic is that we eat 50% of our meals outside of the home, but a lot of those meals that we eat inside of the home are actually prepared meals that are prepared elsewhere or microwaved or what have you. The fact is that real food prepared simply is less expensive and obviously more beneficial than any kind of junk food there is.
Less expensive? I think there's a myth that I gather you think it's a myth that junk food is cheaper.
Well, it is a myth. I mean, if you go out and price, you know, everybody says, well, but a family of four can eat for $10 at McDonald's. But the fact is, a family of four, I mean, we went out and bought a bunch of McDonald's food and saw what it costs, and a family of four eats for $26 or $28 at McDonald's. So it's not exactly cheap. You can roast a chicken or buy a piece of fish or make almost anything you can think of for four people for $15 or $20. I mean, except exotic, wonderful, you know, things. But so the fact is that junk food is really not less expensive. It is more convenient, but it's a question of getting our priorities in order.
Whatever happened to cooking?
Well, what did happen to cooking? I mean, the microwave happened to cooking. A marketing campaign and the billions of dollars to convince us that cooking was too difficult and too much of a pain, and that the arts of domestic arts were ridiculous for everybody, and it worked. And you have to, you know, it's a complicated question because you have to look at the fact that in the post-war years, women were getting ready to say, I don't want to do this anymore if this is all there is for me. And men were still in a position where cooking was associated with being feminine. So as a result, we had a couple of generations of people who really didn't cook, and they didn't teach their kids how to cook. And, you know, I like to think we're coming out of that now, but there's not really hard evidence to show that.
Let me go back to Mark Bittman once again with the New York Times. Brian Wansink, back to you at Cornell University, author of Mindless Eating, Why We Eat More Than We Think. How important is the parental factor?
Oh, it's tremendously important as role models. We've done a series of interesting studies just recently, and for a long time, a disproportionate amount of the credit or blame has gone to the mother of the household for how the family eats. And indeed, if you take a look at the nutritional gatekeeper, this is the person who purchases and prepares the majority of food in the home. About 80% of the two parent households, women claim that they're the nutritional gatekeeper. But we find that they control 72% of the food their children and their family ends up eating. They do it either for the better or for the worse. It's for the better if they're making something nutritious, like Mark mentioned. It's for the worst if they end up just plopping down a something they bought somewhere else and say, dig in. You know, they do it for the better, depending on where they decide to take their family to a restaurant, and for the worst if they end up just going through a drive-thru. But what we found, interestingly, just recently, is that although this nutritional gatekeeper determines largely what food ends up in the house, it's the father who ends up determining often what gets eaten once the food's in the house. But unfortunately, it's in the wrong direction, because frequently the bad habits that children end up getting end up being ones where they model from a dad who doesn't eat his vegetables, who has too many pieces of pizza, and so forth.
We all remember George H.W. Bush, who didn't like his broccoli.
Broccoli.
There's a great example of a guy. You could call him a father figure, I suppose, if he's the president of the United States.
That's very good. You know, and I love what was said a little bit earlier. Mark was talking about cooking at home. And you know, the good news about this is we had started the study a while back, taking people who claimed they were non-cookers, that they didn't know how to cook, and asked them for 7 evenings to make a different meal from scratch. I mean, it could be pasta one night, it could be roasted chicken. And it's remarkable how much a person improves in their cooking confidence if they have to just make 7 dinners in a row by themselves. We are not far away from actually being decent cooks. And that I think that's what can be very empowering to the kind of person who doesn't think they know how to boil water.
Mark Bittman, is it easy to cook 7 different meals, have something different every single night, still have it be inexpensive, and still have it be good?
Well, when you think about the things that people, I mean, the short answer is yes. When you think about the things that people like, which pasta, chicken, eggs, salads, I mean, these are things that are really easy to learn and can almost be intuitive. I think people they haven't learned what to do with ingredients. They don't know. There's a fear of failure, which is kind of odd because it's almost impossible to fail when you're cooking, really. I mean, there are occasional failures, but not that many. Seven is not a big number, and the fact is that I think that when you get to 10 or 12 recipes that you're comfortable with, you have a real repertoire, and you can move forward with that, and you can actually cook on a regular basis with that. The problem is that many people have zero or maybe one.
So let's go back to Peter Weibrauer, our psychiatrist at UCLA. If variety gets you to want to do more of something, wouldn't it be better to have a variety of food and you could achieve what Mark Bittman and Brian Wansink want to see?
You mean in terms of the novel opportunity?
Yeah, exactly. Sure.
Well, yeah, that's, I think, perhaps the quick thought, but you know, it's a little more complicated than that because there are huge varieties of food out there, but we've lost the art of really putting them together. As was said earlier, many people don't know how to cook anymore, and so that's why they move to fast food. The other thing is that they are working extraordinarily hard. I mean, one of the things that you look at when you look at obesity in terms of the international picture, there are some countries which are much more obese than others, and that tends to correlate not only with the individuals in the country who are obese being of lower socioeconomic class, unfortunately, but they're also the ones who are working extremely hard, usually with two jobs, and they don't have the knowledge, nor do they have the money to do some of the things that we've been discussing, which is very unfortunate. So it means that you changing this, you know, moving this monster, this turning this great vessel is very, very difficult. And so it has to start with what we were talking about earlier, which is education. So when you have a variety of opportunity out there, especially if you've got it locally and you've got it socially entwined with the family, then in fact you will be able over a generation to change the way in which we eat. It didn't start overnight. Americans have been gaining weight slowly for 80 years, but the explosion occurred in the last 20 years, the last two generations or so. And so to reverse that, we've got to have a massive program of education that goes right back into the schools, not only helps the children understand that, but helps their parents understand that, and creates really a different culture around the issue of eating, which is what all the guests have been describing, which is that we then go back into a situation where the family sitting around the table, having cooked the meal together, I mean, that is ideal, but it's not going to get there. We're not going to get there easily. So I think it's important for us to recognize that. Otherwise, we'll have a false sense of optimism.
Mark Bittman, do you also see a class difference in who does what? Is that a part of what we have to deal with on a cultural national basis?
There is a class difference, but I think it's I don't want to say it's overplayed, but I think in a way, poor people are used as a sort of excuse for less poor people to not cook. So you have what you said before. It's so much easier, it's so much cheaper to eat junk food. Why should we bother to eat real food? I mean, the fact is that the 5 or 10% of the population that's eating better is better educated and does have more money. But there's a lot of people in between those people and truly poor people who can afford to eat well, who are literate, who can understand things, who can be taught. And I think the problem at this point is that education is really not enough and that we need to have programs that are a little stronger than education. And those are programs that are going to disincentivize, if that's a word, but discourage, let's say, the consumption of bad food, of junk food, and encourage the consumption of good food. And we really don't have that in this country.
Peter Weiber, I don't want to lose the connection that you make between the consumption of food, the overconsumption of food, and how the brain works in that regard, and the analogy, if it's not just more than analogy, to the way we buy. I take it the brain causes us to do the same kinds of things in the commercial world.
Oh, yes. We're wired up. I mean, the same mechanisms inside your head are the ones that will make, on Black Friday, people rush off to the stores that has made them eat more on Thanksgiving than perhaps they later think they should have done. So that's exactly right. The same mechanisms are there. They're not differentiated. It's just the issue of what is the novel thing attracting you at the time. So I think that, we live in a totally different society from that in which we evolved. And so you have to come back to the idea that it's only the thing that we do have, which other animals don't have, is we have a thinking brain, a mind that can decide and make choices. Our whole society is based on that, and we've been making some bad choices, as was said at the very beginning. So I think we can go back. I think we can. But, we do have to think about our society. I agree to some degree with what Mark has said, but not entirely, because you can go to South Los Angeles here, and you can find places where there is essentially a food desert. There are no grocery stores where you can buy the sort of food that you can take home and cook, and many people don't leave the ghetto. And so, in fact, it's not quite as easy as I think we would hope it would be. That doesn't mean we should give up. What it means is we have to intensify and be very creative in our educational programs for young children. For example, the Congress has just passed has just decided that tomato paste is a vegetable, yes? Well, that is not terribly well informed. And it's taken a lot of effort, as you know, Warren, to kick out the sodas from the L.A. school districts. We're doing much better now. But these are very significant social issues that bear upon the subject.
And Mark Bittman, in some of these food deserts that Professor Weiber is talking about, there are lots of fast food places.
Yeah, I think we're mostly in agreement here. There are lots of fast food places. It is difficult for people to live in so-called food deserts to find real food, and that needs to be changed not just by education but by physically putting the food in those neighborhoods, making it available, subsidizing it if necessary, and making it so that people can find the stuff they need.
Peter Weiber, once again, back to the issue of overconsumption of material goods. I suppose we ought to point out also that, of course, consumption is 70% of the economy of the United States. So maybe in some ways we're talking about something that has a downside. But I would think it would be easier to resist the kind of material habituation and addiction in the consumption of goods than it would be in the consumption of food, because that is such a physical experience.
Yes, I mean, I think there's a variation in things. Of course, we consume not only material goods, and we've actually had just come off a sort of a addictive bubble where we were the whole housing thing, where we were hoping that the house would go up and you could actually live in it and buy it at the same time and still have enough money to go on vacation because you were sure it was going to go up in 10 years. So in fact, what we do in our society is we have managed to create mechanisms whereby we can consume more and more because we like it so much. Why not? I mean, we're very greedy creatures. I mean, you have to face it. Except when we sit back and we ask ourselves, does this make long-term sense? And then we're very sensible creatures, and we, I think, are on the cusp now of obesity is just the leading edge, which is very easily visible. We're now on the edge of saying, this didn't make sense. You know, you can't live on debt for the rest of your life. You can't live on eating too much for the rest of your life. Well, you can, but it's going to be a much shorter life. So I think in putting all these things together, we are now, I agree with the optimism, where the pendulum is now beginning to swing back. And I think as long as we're thoughtful about it and we consider, in fact, in some ways, the behavioral neuroscience can help us. If we consider the way we really are, we know ourselves in terms of our biology and our psychology, the sort of things that Brian has been studying and so on, I think that we have a chance of
pushing the needle back. And it's very important because America got here first. Just because we've been so successful as a material development society, we can, if we can get this right and we can move the trigger back again, you know, we will be doing a service to everybody. China's not far behind us in terms of rapid accumulation of obesity. Some countries in Europe, particularly interestingly, the Anglophone countries, Britain, Australia, New Zealand, they all have Germany, they all have obesity problems. So I think that we can, if we can grasp this problem, move back, I think we will be doing a service to everybody.
Brian, one thing, very quickly, we just have a couple of minutes left, but everybody who's listening to this program is going to go on a diet tomorrow, no question about that. Why don't diets work, and what's a better way to lose weight?
Well, one reason they don't work is they resist against the two biggest things we've got going for us, and that is our psychology and our physiology. They don't work because we typically go on these tremendous deprivation diets that our body can't sustain and that our mind doesn't want to sustain. Because if you deprive yourself of anything, whether it be food or television or affection or anything you love, when you get over that period, you go back and you essentially, you know, overcompensate. Yeah. So that's the best thing you can do, and we say this all the time, that the best diet is the diet you don't know you're on. So just make some of these small changes, smaller plates, rearrange your cupboard, don't bring the stuff in the house in the first place, and just make a couple things that are very palatable. Because I think that one of the big solutions to a lot of what we face is just the resignation. It's the resignation people have that they can't cook, the resignation that it's not their fault, the resignation that they're always going to be fat because diets don't work. And fighting that resignation would be the first educational battle I'd set up.
Okay, so smaller plates, taller glasses, they keep the candy a few weeks away from the desk, and you'll be on the way. I want to thank all of you very much for being on our program today. Brian Wansink, again, at Cornell University at the Food and Brand Lab, author of Mindless Eating, Why We Eat More Than We Think. Peter Weibrow, a psychiatrist at UCLA at the Semmel Institute for Neuroscience and Human Behavior, author of American Mania, When More Is Not Enough. And Mark Pittman, columnist for the Opinion Pages and Magazine at the New York Times, for many years, the minimalist food writer, author of many cookbooks, including How to Cook Everything. Good to have all of you on our program. We've heard that overeating and overconsumption are not the road to happiness. That's the assumption of this program. Now we'll hear from a woman who says she knows at least one right way, and that's gratitude on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
Warman Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. The Declaration of Independence says we're all entitled to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. How is happiness measured, and how can it best be pursued? Sonia Lubomirsky is professor of psychology at the University of California, Riverside. She's author of The How of Happiness, A Scientific Approach to Getting the Life You Want. Welcome to our program.
Thank you.
Let's start with gratitude. What's the function of gratitude in the pursuit of happiness?
Well, gratitude is very strongly associated with happiness. If you try to be grateful on a daily basis, express gratitude, you will probably be happier. I mean, when you're grateful, you're not experiencing negative emotions. You're not taking your life for granted. You're viewing people around you more positively, so it has a lot of positive consequences.
How do you discipline yourself to feel a gratitude when you're in a lousy mood?
Right. You know, I think gratitude is one of the hardest strategies, sort of activities to try. In fact, some people just can't do it. They find it too hokey or corny to do. But you just have to find the right way. So I do studies where I ask people to practice gratitude in different ways, and for some people, counting their blessings once a week might be an effective strategy, so they write down what they're grateful for once a week. For other people, some people don't like that. It doesn't work for them, and so they might write gratitude letters to people who they care about, or text or email people and say thank you, you know, in a really genuine, sincere way. That's the hard part.
How do you measure the impact of this kind of thing on happiness?
Well, we do what are called happiness interventions, where we ask people to practice gratitude and other strategies. Also, we also have control groups. And we measure happiness before, during, and after, and at follow-up. And there are lots of ways of measuring happiness, but usually we ask people, you know, how happy are you? How often do you experience positive emotions? How content are you with your life? So there's no happiness thermometer. So the only thing we really can do is just ask people to report their happiness.
How important is happiness to people?
Extremely important. So actually, researchers go all around the world and they survey people about their goals in life. And a number of studies have found that when you ask people, what are your top goals in life, pretty much in every culture study, people put happiness at the top of their list. I mean, there's some small differences among cultures, but we all pretty much want to be happy. And so the question that I study is sort of how can we do that?
And how many different ways are there to be happy? You mentioned different kinds of cultures. One would assume that what makes people happy in one place, it may not do so in another.
Absolutely. So we all pursue happiness differently, not just between cultures, but within cultures. And so my laboratory studies all different kinds of strategies that people can do to become happier. So gratitude is one of them, to try to express gratitude. But we also, for example, in some studies, ask people to do random acts of kindness for others, or to try to be more optimistic, or to try to savor positive experiences in their life. And so, you know, all of these things work to some extent, but you have to sort of choose the right strategy for you, for the situation.
It's easy to say be more optimistic, but if for some reason things are going wrong, you know, you've lost your job or somebody has died, or, you know, there are a lot of reasons for not feeling optimistic, or, you know, some plan that you have is shot. How, under those circumstances, do you just say, well, I'm going to be more optimistic?
Right, absolutely. I mean, it's very hard. And I'm not saying that we should try to be optimistic or grateful, like, all the time. So there may be a time that you need to really think about, you know, the problems in your life and try to address them. But then what happens is that happier people, they tend to bounce back faster, so they're more resilient. So of course, they're not going to be optimistic all the time, you know, when they have a setback or something bad happens. But then they bounce back, and then they regain their optimism. And the thing about being optimistic is that it can become a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? When you go on a job interview, you want to be optimistic because you're more likely to get the job if you are. And so, but we have to choose the situation and to be flexible, sort of not to be happy or grateful or optimistic all the time, but also not to kind of brood on our unhappiness.
There are, again, you're saying then it's not necessarily a bad thing to be unhappy. There are reasons for it, and you don't want to make yourself more unhappy by sitting around and saying, wait a minute, I'm not happy.
That's right. I mean, there are definitely important functions of negative emotions. I mean, sadness, unhappiness, anger, fear. They have important functions. Sometimes we should be afraid and we should be angry when there's injustice. But again, people who are generally happy tend to kind of bounce back, and they don't ruminate or brood about their negative emotions, because that just makes it worse.
Is happiness important to physical health?
Absolutely. So there's lots of studies showing, longitudinal studies, for example, that follow people across time, and they find that people who experience more positive emotions or who are happier at one point in time tend to be healthier sort of across the lifespan or several years later. So some studies show that happier people live longer, that happier people have stronger immune function, they experience less pain, et cetera. So I think it's really important for health, and of course health is critical to our well-being.
But still, there are no health tests of any kind that would show you that somebody was happy or not. There's no device at this point,
right,
for measuring that in a physical scientific
way. Well, there are
way.
Some. You know, I'm not a neuroscientist, but there are some ways to measure to take measures of the brain. So, for example, people who are happier tend to have more activation on the left side of their frontal cortex. Now, that's very interesting, and it's a correlate. It's a correlation. We're not sure what it means, but there are some ways. But we're not going to sort of look at your brain to see if you're happy. It's much easier just to ask yourself. To ask you if you're happy.
Back to gratitude, where we started. What is it that most people are grateful for?
The studies that I have done, I haven't coded all the answers, but I often ask people to count their blessings, to write down, say, five things that they're grateful for. And there's the by far the number one response is mom.
The tattoo.
M-O-M, your mom, and dad is number two.
Well, that's interesting. They outnumber other things. What's next?
I don't have a list. I think after that, it's a variety of things. So you're sort of grateful for your health, for your job, for your kids, family, resources. But So they kind of, they're sort of, after that, there's a diverse number of answers.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for being on our program, Sonia Lubomirsky, professor of psychology, University of California, Riverside, author of The How of Happiness, A Scientific Approach to Getting the Life You Want. It's good to have you on our show. And I hope all of our listeners are having a very happy Thanksgiving Day. Today's program produced by Sonia Geis with Karen Razner and Caitlin Schamberg, our technical director, Phil Richards. Email us, share your thoughts on our comment page, kcrw.com/To The Point. Join the conversation on To The Point's Facebook page. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To The Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.